Going to call to order.
I don't like teasing either.
The House Committee on Human Services today, April 1st. No joking about that. 2009. But I will remind you to turn off your cell phones, your Blackberries, your Blueberries, your
She's not joking about that either.
Well, because it affects the sound system. So I'm asking you to turn them completely off, not just on mute. And I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2974. Keeley.
This bill prohibits the possession of tobacco to individuals under 21 years of age unless in a private residence in the presence and with the permission of a parent or guardian. It establishes the crime of distribution and provides for penalties and prohibits regulation of vending machines in areas accessible to individuals under the age of 21.
Great. Representative Comp, I think you have somebody coming to testify with you.
Yes. Doctor.
Great. And Representative Mitch Greenlick.
Go ahead. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Betty Comp, and I represent House District 22, and it's my pleasure to be here in front of you this morning to talk about House Bill 2974. I bring you this bill as a parent, as a grandmother, and as a school administrator, and most of all, when I wrote this bill, there's one person that came to mind, and that was my father-in-law. And he died of throat cancer. I was his primary caregiver in the last 6 months of his life, which meant constant transportation up to the Veterans Hospital for chemo, radiation, everything that they could do. And yet, if you know people that have had throat cancer, there wasn't a whole lot that could be done. And he died a very, very, very fast death of not being able to eat. And I think of him frequently when I used to see students smoking, chewing, having tobacco addictions in schools. And it's like, oh, I hope that you don't end up with a serious cancer from this addiction. And so this bill would increase the age that you could possess and purchase tobacco, and that is for the purpose of prevention. There's a tremendous amount of peer pressure with our youth, and once one person is smoking or just hanging out and think, oh, okay, I can have some cigarettes, I could do this. And it starts off as just something that's real casual. But as we see and know for a fact, the statistics are real clear that tobacco is addictive to many people. Part of my testimony, you'll find that at least 4.5 million adolescents under the age of 17 are cigarette smokers in the United States. 90% of those smokers began before the age of 21. That's the prevention part. If we increase this age of purchasing and availability to 21, possibly a lot of those young people will choose not to smoke. Nearly 5.5% of all 8th graders smoke daily. 12% of 10th graders, 20% of 12th graders. Each day, nearly 6,000 children under the age of 18 start smoking. 2,000 of them will become regular smokers. That calculates to almost 800,000 smokers per year. Colleagues, I just hope that by increasing this age that we will get tobacco out of our schools and that it will change these statistics appreciably. I got to tell you a short story because I have to go to committee too. One of the reasons why I ran for office is because I'm so passionate about all children being successful in schools, and that is to improve literacy so that all children can read so they can be successful. Along with being able to read, they have to be healthy. They cannot be healthy and do a productive life. So if we can deal with both issues here, it brings great joy to be here today. So that wasn't in my testimony. I just had to share. It is heartbreaking to see this happen. Some people will say that this bill comes with a price tag. There is no price tag. This should be cost savings. I couldn't even think about how much it cost in health care when my father-in-law was dying of his throat cancer. It was 6 months constant, in and out of the hospital. Constant. I mean, for weeks at times. So I can't calculate what those costs were. And there's no change in the current statute as far as how this would be implemented. There's when people purchase tobacco today, you're asked to see your identification. Those same standards would be in place. The major components of this legislation stays intact. The only change is the increase from age 18 to 19. I could come to you before and say that with a bill, tobacco, you know, about tobacco education and mandate that we ought to teach this in our health curriculum, that would cost money. I could come to you and say that we could do anti-smoking advertisements. I assure you, we've tried that in schools. It doesn't work. That, too, would cost money. In these challenging economic times, when better to have the conversation about how to save lives and save money and for our state? And so with that, it would be great if Oregon stepped out and did what has, well, I won't be a Star Trekkie here and say step, go beyond where no other state has gone before. But no state has done a change like this. Several states have increased the age of purchase up to age 19, but nobody has moved it up to 21. And I would like to have that opportunity for Oregon to be ahead of this and say we're going to help our children in this way. But I appreciate your consideration and hope that we can move this on to a work session in the near future. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any quick questions before she runs off to her next committee? All right. Thank you so much for bringing this bill to us. Representative Greenlick.
Thank you very much. First of all, I'm here to support House Bill 2974 in its existing form. But I would like to propose an addition to that bill to move it one step further. Today's headline in the Oregonian, which do I need permission to use this as a prop?
You have my permission.
Points out 500 people died in Oregon last year as a result of overdoses from methadone, oxycodone, heroin, meth, cocaine, and a combination of those drugs. 500 people. That's far enormously overshadowed by the number of people who died in Oregon last year as a result of smoking-related illnesses. Now, we're concerned about these drugs when, in fact, tobacco is virtually as addictive as any of these drugs. Doctors use methadone as a part of the treatment of heroin addiction, and it's available for that and other things on prescription only. But we have a very serious epidemic in this state of diseases related to an addictive drug. More than half of the people who smoke their first cigarette become addicted to cigarettes. Now, you all know people that have smoked their first marijuana cigarette. I happen not to be one of them for a variety of odd reasons, but you all know people who smoke marijuana who never became addicted to it. That's because tobacco is a more addictive product than marijuana is, and yet we fill our jails with people who sell marijuana. In a hearing in our committee, in the House Healthcare Committee on tobacco tax, Representative Thompson suggested that if we want to use taxes as a way of preventing people from smoking, why not simply ban tobacco products in the United States at all? Mark Nelson suggested that same thing in a reaction to this bill in today's Oregonian, and pointed out the problem with that is that there's a big hole in revenue. And the truth is we have become as addicted to tobacco revenue as the users of cigarettes are addicted to the nicotine product. I believe we need to stop that, and what you have in front of you is the -1 amendments that would make nicotine products a prescription-only product. In the last session, we made Sudafed a prescription-only product because even though it was legal to sell in every other state in the country, it was creating a social problem. It was facilitating the cooking of meth, and we perceived the cooking of meth as a problem. We knew putting Sudafed as a prescription-only product wouldn't stop the supply of meth because the Mexican cartel could fill the supply need with their product from Mexico. But what we did know is it would stop cooking of meth if we kept that product out of the hands of meth cookers. Your committee heard a lot of testimony in the past sessions on how the children living in meth homes had to be put into foster care. Those kids who were getting 100 milligrams of methamphetamine a day out of the air because of meth cooking. And we took the dramatic step, we were the first state in the country, to make Sudafed a prescription-only product to stop that product. Now, why does it seem so unusual to people that we ought to make nicotine products a prescription-only product? Would doctors prescribe them? They would prescribe them in the treatment of narcotic addiction. And that's basically what our doctors are treating, a narcotic addiction. This Dash 1 amendment you have in front of you is written as a gut and stuff of 2974. I would propose we change the gut and stuff principle, that we put, it would be a Dash 2 that I'd be happy to get prepared if it moves you, that we add this to 2974 and have the increase in age as the first step of the product of the process, and make the prescription only component of our anti-smoking campaign effective at the of July of 2011 or July of 2013, which would give us 4 years to move in that direction and give us 4 years to wean ourselves off our addiction to tobacco revenue. Now, we use tobacco revenue for a variety of things. A big chunk of tobacco revenue we use to reduce smoking, because the taxes itself have a dampening effect on smoking. And we use it for anti-smoking campaigns. And we use it to reimburse the state for the cost of tobacco-related illnesses under Medicaid. If we make this a prescription only, we would obviate the need for many of those other features. It's a bold, it's an unusual step. We're here on April Fool's Day, but I assure you this is not intended as a joke. This is a very serious solution to a plague that's affecting our state, and I really urge you to take it seriously as a possible solution to the problem we face with nicotine addiction. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions of Representative? He also has a meeting he's attending. Representative Maurer, you look eager to ask a question.
Actually, I have several questions.
I'm sure he does.
What is the medical benefit of nicotine to make it a prescription?
It's used to deal with a nicotine addiction, and physicians would, just as, for example, methadone is a prescription drug, used to deal with heroin addiction. So my assumption is that physicians dealing with the nicotine addiction, which is anybody who's still smoking at that point, would use them to wean people eventually off cigarettes onto perhaps a nicotine substitute on their way to treat these patients toward recovery. And it is possible to be in recovery. Several of us in this room are in recovery from nicotine addiction. But we know it was a hard problem, and I think this would help.
Okay.
Follow up?
I have several follow-ups, Madam Chair. So I would like to see the literature on the use of nicotine in medical as a alternative to addiction.
We use nicotine patches. We use nicotine lollipops. We use nicotine gum, originally prescribed by prescription. We've let it off, and the fact that they're out there now available to feed a nicotine addiction seems to me a problem.
Okay. Madam Chair, follow up. The next question has to do with the money.
I'm sorry?
With the money. Because mm-hmm. under the current governor's recommended budget, prescriptions for everybody on the health plan goes away. The government cuts $110 million and eliminates prescriptions for everybody on the Oregon health plan. But it's replaced with $100 million in new cigarette taxes. So where would we fill that hole with $100 million missing from cigarette taxes?
That's where my proposal is, that we make the effective date of this action either July of 2011 or July of 2013, which gives us a chance to allow economic recovery and the place where we can find other sources of funding to deal with with making sure we have the Oregon Health Plan. The notion that somehow we have to use the revenue from the sales of an addictive product, a dangerous product, a product that kills, as a way of supporting the health plan is absurd to me. We're forced into it, but I believe it's I believe it's morally corrupt to do that. And I think it seems perfectly appropriate to use funds to repay the state for the $8 a pack that it costs in specific medical care expenses for every pack of cigarettes smoked. That seems to be morally appropriate. But it's, I think, irreprehensible as a state to base a basic state program on the profits from the sale of a murderous, addicting drug. And that's what we're doing with a tobacco tax.
Can I move on, Representative? I'll come back to you if you need. Anybody over here had a question? Looks like they're pretty mute. Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And last but not least, I think that the state of Oregon underspends on tobacco prevention and reduction. And in fact, we don't use anything from cigarette taxes for tobacco prevention. The Master Settlement Agreement, we get hundreds of millions of dollars a year, and we're paying back bonds. I think that we need to spend more on tobacco prevention reduction as a vehicle. And make
is
there a prescription.
A question in this, Representative?
Yes, Madam Chair. if we're going to try to make a prescription drug, I think that puts up a whole set of problems. In fact, we probably should just ban it.
Yes, well, but this is as close to banning it as we get. I do agree with you. We don't spend enough on tobacco prevention. But those of us that have spent a lifetime in public health dealing with these kind of issues know it's a very weak way of dealing with addictions by putting the burden on the individual to change and giving them education about how important it is to change. We know if we're going to change the behavior in these issues, we need to change the culture. We need to do it in a place where it's strongest. We need to put the cultural barriers into place. Imagine a proposal to make heroin and cocaine legal and trying to combat it by having a strong education program. So we'll make those drugs legal and we'll tax them, and then we'll use the taxes to educate people about the dangers of using heroin and cocaine. Now, that's absurd on its face. Why isn't it absurd on its face to do the same thing with tobacco? Why does this seem like such a radical approach when this is a drug that kills more people than heroin, that kills more people than cocaine, and yet we say we can't control it in a real way because we're addicted to the profits that we get from its sale? It just strikes me as being completely nuts. But it was your proposal and Thompson's that we actually ban cigarettes that led me in this direction. This is, I think, as close as we get to it in a way that's feasible and actually makes sense.
Last follow-up, please.
And I thank you for your suggestions on that.
And your arguments have swayed me, and I would support your amendment.
There you go.
Any last questions? Thank you so much, Representative, for taking
your
time this morning to present this to us. Please identify yourself. Okay.
For the record, my name is Dr. James Lace. I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. Representative Tomei, members of the committee, thank you very much for having me come and testify today. I just wanted to clear up just a couple of things that Representative Greenlick brought up. Nicotine is as addictive as cocaine and heroin, but it's not as addictive as methamphetamine. Methamphetamine is four times as addictive. There's actually nothing on the face of the earth as addictive as methamphetamine, just to set that record straight on that. And that's one of the reasons why we have such a problem with methamphetamine. Each day I get to deal with the problems of smoking-related illness. 20% of our moms at Salem Hospital smoke. It affects the lower socioeconomic groups a little bit higher than others, but it is a very addictive substance, and it's very hard to get those moms to stop smoking during their pregnancy. We have smoking-related issues with newborn babies. We have smoking-related issues with children that grow up in a smoking environment, increased incidence of colds, ear infections, pneumonia. The secondhand smoke also, there's a clear indication that there's an increase of cancer associated with tobacco usage. This bill is designed to slow down the process a little bit. Actually, if you look at teenage smokers, they have pack identification by age 13 already. In other words, they've already got an image in their mind about what kind of cigarette they want to smoke as they get older. So if we can slow that down a little bit through a combination of taxes, delaying the ability to purchase cigarettes until they're 21, even though this would be the first time that any state has ever gone that far, we think that there'll be a benefit to society. Certainly there'll be a benefit to our children in this country, in the state, and that we can slow down the problems associated with tobacco-related illnesses. It's a big problem, and we spend a lot of money as a state taking care of people. And when I counsel parents who come in with their child who comes back in over and over and over again because they have ear infections, they've got repeated colds, they have all these other things, they assure me that they don't smoke in the car, in the house, anywhere else, but they're coming in, their clothes are reeking of tobacco. I have a hard time believing that. And so I take them at their face and I say, great, that's great. I'm glad you're respecting that. But we really want you to actually stop smoking. You're going to save a lot of money in the long run, and you're going to certainly improve the health of your child in the long run. So from the medical stand, we would like you to be in favor of 2974 as another small step. There would be some issues about making this a prescribed substance. We did that with Sudafed because that is the only substance that's used for methamphetamine production. That's a little bit different than making nicotine a prescription-only item. And so that one would have to be thought out a little bit more, I think, from our standpoint, to ask us to do that. It's easy for us not to write a prescription for Sudafed, by the way. That's an easy no for anybody that's involved with methamphetamine. You just say, no, go use something else or don't use any of that stuff. But as far as, what Representative Greenlick is proposing, that's a little more radical, and that would take a little more careful thought about that, because how it affects us and what we do every day in our office and the number of prescriptions that we'd be asked for would be a bit overwhelming, considering that 20% of the population smoke cigarettes. So just keep that in mind if that has some movement to it and get some traction going with that. So, but this is a good step. We think it would make a big difference in terms of slowing down the availability of cigarettes. And kids get cigarettes from their friends. They get cigarettes from their parents. They get them from other sources. If we can slow the process down, we think it would be a worthwhile endeavor.
Thank you so much, Doctor. Any questions?
Yes, Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. Having grown up in an age where I couldn't do anything till I was 21, and when I got to 21, it was kind of a dud. But has it always been? Have cigarettes always been available? I never bought any, so I don't know. At the age of 18, or was there a period of time when you had to be 21 to buy cigarettes?
Maybe we could ask somebody else
you can buy cigarettes now if you're 18.
Right, but I'm saying, wasn't there a period of time in our society that you had to be 21 to buy cigarettes? Does anybody recall?
Let's pose that question to somebody
who might know. All right, thank you.
I'm not sure that you do. Any questions for the doctor before we let him return to his practice?
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate you taking out time to do that. I'm going to be closing the public hearing, and I'll be opening it up again later. But we have a representative here who's supposed to be in another meeting, so I'm going to close this, the public hearing 2974, and open up the hearing on House Bill 2897 and Representative Wisnant.
Good morning, and I will not have any April Fool's jokes either to expedite. I'm sure everyone's happy about that. We'll let Representative Olson do that. Madam Chair and honorable colleague members, you have a copy of my testimony. I'm going to try to go through it quickly. Thank you for hearing this bill. I'm Gene Wisnett, State Representative, District 53. I think House Bill 2897-1 is a simple bill, and I understand you have the Dash 1 amendments.
Yes, we do.
The bill only requires the courts to make written findings regarding preferences for and placement of child award for relatives where the judge, in a few cases, decides that contrary to the placement decision of Department of Human Services, placement with a relative is not in the best interest of the child. I serve as a state representative on the State Commission for Children and Families. A few years ago, I learned about the research in placing foster children with relatives and the success of this program. I was hoping Mr. Smith from the State Commission was going to come up and he'll give you a brief comment now or later, Madam Chair, about the success of this with DHS and the Commission in placing children. It's really important. I think last session this committee may have heard that presentation about how it really assures the success or better success of foster children. Let me briefly describe the situation which brings you House Bill 2897-1. I have a friend who had custody of a granddaughter for 13 years, since the granddaughter was 20 months old. The grandmother's daughter was addicted to drugs and gave custody to the grandmother. Then the daughter later had another child and kept that child for a period, I'm assuming, which I shouldn't, for the support funds. Finally, she decided she could not keep the child and wanted to give the child up. The grandmother at the time was offered the child, but she was having some medical issues and said she wanted to be sure she was okay and could handle the additional responsibility. Thank God that the issue was not serious, and then she petitioned to have the child, the second granddaughter, who would then be living with a grandmother and her sister. DHS on two occasions recommended placement with a grandmother and sibling after two sensitive issue adoption committee recommendations. However, the judge decided not to place the second granddaughter with the grandmother. The grandmother, after spending over $20,000 to win guardianship, gave up. I believe she and the public are due an explanation. This bill will probably not help my friend, but maybe it will assure the courts extra time to try to place children with relatives unless it's not in the best interest of the child. If so, then they need to explain why. I had great support in drafting this bill from Legislative Counsel Belisa Sidlick with the Legislative Counsel, and I had several meetings with DHS and Justice Department. The Dash 1 you have in front of you, we worked this week, and to be sure that there was no physical, and I had help from Judge Nan Waller and Nancy Cousin from the courts, Mickey Siris, Kevin George, Rebecca Orff, Kamala Sugar from Justice Department, and Belisa again, and my staff. Madam Chair and committee members, from our power meeting, I described that meeting as a power meeting, we have a bill that I think is supported by DHS, Justice, and the courts, and will accomplish my intent with good policy and no physical and minimum impacts on the judges. I urge you to pass the bill in support of preference for placement of foster kids with relatives. Any questions, Madam Chair? Please.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions of Representative Smith?
I have Mr. George from DHS. He can tell you briefly that they did some research about the number of cases we're talking about. So.
Okay.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Kevin George. I work as the Foster Care Program Manager at the Department of Human Services. We appreciate the opportunity Representative Wisnett gave us in helping develop the Dash 1 amendments through the power group. I appreciate that. It's nice to know I was in a power meeting this week already. It's only Wednesday. But it has been, it's important to be exclusive in that decision-making so that all parties of the cases are involved in that. So that was very helpful to do that. We did an informal survey of our branch offices with our managers and asked around how many cases do you see over the last couple of years that this bill may have negatively impacted if it went through. And we only saw three. And in that negative impact, I mean in that only three cases over the last couple of years would have been impacted by this, where we had a decision we wanted to place with relatives and a court decided otherwise. Without really providing an explanation. So it's very minimal, if anything, at this point in time. I think it actually also supports some of the direction that the legislature went through last session through Senate Bill 414, talking about preference and diligent efforts for relatives, requiring the department to do extra efforts. We're doing that. This just takes the next steps then to require the court to document that as well. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Any questions of either of these two witnesses?
Madam Chair.
Representative Maurer.
Mr. George, so the currently a judge makes a decision and that's it. There's no, you don't know the rationale unless the judge sits on the bench and explains the rationale. The judge can make a decision and then that's it.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, most judges will be saying, here's why. Judges do not have the ability by law at this point in time to direct DHS into a specific placement, saying you shall place with the Joneses. They don't have that ability because it actually goes against some federal statute. But what they can say is that if we are intending to place with a specific person, they can say, no, that's not in the child's best interest. And what this bill does is just ask, articulate that in written findings more than just verbally stating it on the record.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you so much for bringing this bill to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I hope the committee will support it and move it forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you. And I know we have Andy Smith and Mark McKechnie. You first.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Smith, and I am here on behalf of the Oregon Commission on Children and, and Families. I believe you're going to be receiving some materials, which is my written testimony, which I'll summarize very quickly, and then there's a packet of materials. On behalf of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, I'm happy to be here today to discuss House Bill 2897. We are officially neutral on the bill, but I want to caveat with the very important point that we support the general intent of the bill, but I know that a number of parties, as has been described briefly just before you, have been working on the amendment, so there's some procedural things and the technicalities of the amendment that we think they're best able to speak to, and we would defer to DHS, the Judicial Department, and other partners, Legislative Council, that have been working on that. But to be clear, the Commission is very supportive of the notion of relative placement and expanding the number of children that are placed with relatives. And in fact, as part of our Casey project, we've set a goal along with DHS and the Casey Family Foundation of increasing that number by 50% by 2011. So this legislation is very consistent with a general, very significant outcome that we are aspiring to in 2011. What I've handed out to you, and I believe you're just receiving them, would be a summary of the Casey project. And if you look on the first page of that, if you all have it, item number two, which is a target goal and outcome, is the increasing of placement to relatives by 50%. So just wanted to place that in the context of the overall Casey project, that this is very consistent, this legislation is consistent with that project and the work that we're doing with DHS and the Casey Family Foundation. The other piece of information that I provided is some general background material on relative placement. It's a good policy paper that will highlight some of the issues, the background challenges, and some of the trends across the country. To give you a little bit of context, this article is a few years old, but at the time it was written, there were 6 million children living with just grandparents that wouldn't take into account aunts or uncles or, of course, other relatives. But to give you a scope of the number of parents that are involved, and all those parents wouldn't necessarily have legal custody, but it just give you a scope of the reality that's occurring. So I'll leave you with that. If you have any questions, I'm happy to follow up at another time, but that's background for you. The last thing I wanted to mention on the record was just to show our appreciation in terms of the commission for the work of Representative Wisnett in terms of this legislation and the work that he does for the state commission. He's been a tremendous advocate for kids consistently in his service in the legislature, and we appreciate that.
Thank you, Andy. Go ahead.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the executive director of the Juvenile Rights Project in Portland. We are a nonprofit public defense firm, and we represented about 1,400 children and parents in the Multnomah County Juvenile Court System in 2008, and we have represented tens of thousands of children in foster care over the last 30 years or so. I came this morning to support the bill as it was originally introduced. So I'm shifting gears slightly, but I did want to provide my testimony in support of the original draft of the bill because we believe it was a good bill, and we are not opposed to the amendments. But I wanted to point out that the original bill addressed a much larger population within the foster care system, and I think the principle has a great deal of merit. I understand that the main reason not to consider that version at this time is the fiscal impact, and certainly we're all very aware of the financial constraints, particularly on the court system, and this may not be the time to pass the original draft, but I would hope that you don't recycle it and keep it for future reference. As has been mentioned many times, the decision to place with relatives or not to place with relatives is one of the most critical decisions in each foster child's lives. The placement of a child with relative can lead to far better outcomes in general than children who are not placed with relatives or other people that they know. We know that it has far-reaching consequences throughout the life of the child welfare case as well as throughout the child's lives. They experience much greater stability, tend not to change foster homes once they're placed with relatives. Their emotional well-being is much greater in measurable ways. And their outcomes in the permanency stage of a case when they're adopted or returned home to their parents eventually or placed in permanent guardianship are all better when they've been placed with relatives, even if the child is not ultimately permanently placed with the relative through adoption or guardianship. And I would just say that if it's fair for the courts to explain in the rare circumstances that they overrule a relative placement, it's certainly fair for the Department of Human Services to explain when they choose to reject an available relative as a placement for a child. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Any questions of either of these two witnesses? Thank you so much for coming today. With that, we have nobody else signed up to testify on that, so I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2897, reopen the public hearing on 2974, and I think several people have signed up for that. Sarah, I know you're one. Was anybody else who?
There was nobody else on the
okay.
list.
All right.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Alsbrooks, and I come before you today in support of House Bill 2974. I would also like to state on the record that I'm a legislative aide to Rep. Carolyn Tomei. However, I come before you to share my personal story, and my views do not reflect those of Rep. Tomei. I have to admit that coming before this committee has caused me a bit of stress. I'm a 22-year-old smoker. However, I try hard not to let people know this. I went back and forth about whether or not I would testify on House Bill 2974, a bill I fully support, because I do feel a bit embarrassed to talk about this subject. Ultimately, I decided that the opportunity to put a face on a young smoker outweighed my fears. I started smoking at the age of 18, literally just a few days after my 18th birthday. I spent my early high school days surrounded by my friends who smoked, but I resisted the pressure to begin. My high school was very small, so everyone knew everyone. This made it easy to get the seniors to buy us cigarettes. Initially, I was strongly opposed to smoking and would actually throw away my friends' cigarettes when they weren't looking. I also used the information received in my health class to try and deter my friends from smoking. The idea of breaking the law actually deterred me for a long time. In my senior year of high school, I was working in a restaurant so I could start saving some money for college. I quickly realized that stepping out for a smoke break meant getting a few extra minutes here and there to sit down and go outside, something that my boss never objected to. The combination of being afforded a break, getting the chance to hang out with my older, at the time cooler, coworkers, having my friends constantly smoke around me, and turning 18 years old ultimately led me to succumb to this addicting habit. I go back and forth about why I ever started smoking, a habit that I hide and I'm not exactly comfortable talking about. I do know two things for sure. One, I wish I would have never started. And two, if I hadn't been able to smoke at the age of 18, I wouldn't be a smoker today. 18 is an age where people are still very impressionable. If I had to wait until I was 21 in order to smoke, I can truly say that I would have never started. I matured quite a bit in those 3 years, definitely enough to understand the real consequences of smoking. At 18, I felt invincible and smoking seemed like the cool thing to do. That coolness outweighed all of the negative impacts in my mind at the age of 18. At 22, I actually know people who are starting to die from smoking. This makes the harmful effects of smoking real and absolutely uncool. Raising the age will generally make it harder for people under the age of 18 to get tobacco products, as well as give them more time to make an informed decision without being pressured by their peers in such a way that exists in a high school atmosphere. I believe this bill, coupled with education the students are currently receiving in schools about staying away from tobacco, will take the accessibility teenagers have to cigarettes, will take away the accessibility teenagers have to cigarettes, which ultimately keeps tobacco out of the hands of our youth. This is a preventative measure the legislature can adopt that will reduce the amount of young people smoking in our society. I commend Representative Comp for bringing forth this bill and giving a voice to young people across the state. I urge your support of House Bill 2974 and hope you will consider a work session in the near future.
Thank you, Sarah. Any questions of this witness? Thank you for coming forward. With that, we have nobody else who has signed up to testify on this bill, so I will close the public hearing on 2974 and open up a public hearing on, I'm going to open up a work session on HCR 8. Healy.
HCR 8 is the memoriam bill we heard earlier this week on Lynn Maureen England, who did diligent work with the Commission for Child Care, and this would extend condolences to her family.
Representative Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I move the HCR 8 to the floor to be adopted as recommended.
Representative Olson moves HCR 8 to the floor to be adopted. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So the motion passes. HCR 8 is adopted. And I close the work session on HCR 8.
Do you want to send that to the consent calendar or?
No.
Reopen that.
Let's see. I
or
think
just find
Representative Kotek. Representative Kotek will open that or carry that bill.
House Bill 2506. Is the family therapist bill.
Oh, right.
We're ready to go. We can pass that today.
Okay. We're going to open up a work session on House Bill 2506. Healy?
This bill requires health benefit plans to include coverage for licensed professional counselors and licensed family therapists acting within their scope of practice. The committee amendment, the -4 amendment, which we're recommended to adopt, revises the statutory definitions, requires specific training in the diagnosis of mental disorders.
Okay. Let's see, Representative Buckley is not here.
He has suggested, and Representative Maurer has agreed to adopt that. And I know Elizabeth Kushwa is back there. If anyone has any questions about the bill.
Do we have the -4s?
Yes.
I have the -2.
Do we have them in our pile here?
I don't have a -4.
You and Representative Cowan and Representative Freeman won't have them in your pile, probably because I emailed them, but everyone else should have them in their stack.
If it was just my lack of technology, don't hold up on my part.
Right. Are we
going to
have the -4 summarized?
The -4 does do some revision of the statutory definition, requires training in the diagnosis of mental disorders, and Liz can come forward and tell you about those if you want.
Yes, come on up, please.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Kushwa, representing the Oregon Coalition for Consumer Mental Health Protection and Choice. With me is Larry Connor. The Dash 4 amendments finally do what the bills intended to do. We had had some language problems. It's tough to come up with Dash 4 amendments on an unopposed bill, but we managed it. And so what this does finally is specify the definitions of both licensed professional counselors and licensed and marriage family therapists, where at the same time protecting alternative providers and everybody else operating in their scope. And Larry could speak specifically to the amendments, but essentially it's everything we explained to you the first time, only it's right.
That's always nice. Larry, why don't you go ahead?
My name is Larry Connor. I'm a licensed professional counselor from Portland, Oregon. Do you have questions that you want to address to me, or do you want me just to kind of go run through? I'm going to essentially say what I said last time when I was with you.
Why don't you just give a very abbreviated message of what you said last time?
I will attempt to do that. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, Section 2, again, exempts the self-insured from this legislation. Section 4, there's a new piece that you have not seen before, which is a definition of assessment.
And that's in the Dash 4.
Dash 4, yes.
Correct. Thank you.
There's a definition of assessment. We were asked by Oregon Psychological Association to clarify that we would assess within the limits of our training. And that defines that for both professional counselors and marriage and family therapists. The definitions in Section 4 of marriage and family therapy and of professional counseling are based on national definitions from our professional organizations. And what we're defining there is that we're practicing within the national scope of practice that's been defined for our professions. The purpose of it is also to differentiate professional counselors and marriage and family therapists from psychologists and social workers on one side and from alternative providers on the other, to give the legislature a very clear definition of what we do, with the hope that the legislature will be able to create a board at some time in the near future to give oversight to those who are unlicensed. And this defines very clearly who fits under this definition. All of this language was worked out with the Oregon Psychological Association and with quite a number of alternative providers. Section 8, where we just again define that in the process of diagnosis and treatment that professional counselors and marriage and family therapists are practicing within national standards of practice. We're required to stay within those standards of practice. Section 9 empowers the board to discipline any licensee who's lost a license due to sexual behavior with a client if that person then proceeds to try to practice as an unlicensed professional. This amendment does not allow that, and the board can go after them and can issue an injunction and fines. That's an expansion of power for the board. Furthermore, that section, as I mentioned last time, exempts anyone working in an agency from this legislation, so agencies are free to hire as they see fit without having to be concerned about this. That's any private or public agency. It also exempts anyone who is licensed under current statute to be a mental health professional in Oregon, and it exempts members of the clergy, and it exempts certified alcohol and drug counselors who work under the rule of Department of Human Services, yes. And lastly, it exempts alternative providers. It's a term we've come up with just because we don't know what else to call them. But anyone who is not practicing, who is not trained as we are, and who or who is practicing in a way different than as defined in the definitions is exempt from this legislation. This language was very carefully worked out, both with Oregon Psychological Association and with the alternative providers. And Section 13, which I believe is new to you, creates a timeline for those persons who are currently eligible for licensure but who have not sought it. Within 1 year, they need to apply for licensure or apply for an internship. It also has an attestation section where all current licensees, all those holding licenses, will attest to the board that they have training and experience in diagnosis of mental disorders, and that they have a period of time where they have to attest to that or they need to stop practicing. So all licensees from this point on, whether coming in or current licensees, will have demonstrated diagnosis and treatment training in diagnosis of mental disorders. And last, Section 14 upgrades the educational requirements to meet national standards in relation to diagnosis and treatment of mental disorders. The purpose of this legislation includes improved consumer protection, as I mentioned before, for those therapists who lose their licenses. Those persons will no longer be able to continue to practice. We are also hoping, and we intend and expect, that there will be more persons seeking licensure in the future in order to benefit from the third-party reimbursement part of this legislation. That is a major part in improving consumer protection. So I raced through. I hope you got that.
You did very well. Thank you. Any questions of either of these two witnesses? Colleagues, this bill has been worked on for several years. They've gotten lots of input from, I think, anybody who had any concerns about it. And I think those concerns have been addressed. And I think, if I look at it, it's a better bill than we've seen in the past. So I'm impressed with this. I'd like to pass it today. Is there any discussion on that? All right. Thank you very much. So, Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 4 amendments dated March 20th, 2009.
Representative
Maurer.
I'm looking for my script here. Moves to adopt the Dash 4 amendments dated March 20th, 2009. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the Dash 4s are amended. Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2506 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Maurer moves House Bill 2506 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair, the only thing is I hope the Senate doesn't mess it up again.
Because
that was a painful process last time.
I know it was. It was very painful.
Madam Chair, do you want to scoot over there and help them out?
Yes, especially you.
You too. There you go.
Yeah,
it's a team. Do you have a license?
Okay, Zach, would you take the roll, please?
Representative Van Ormen.
Aye.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Representative Huffman.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Aye.
Representative Dimbro.
Aye.
Representative Cowan.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Yes.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Chair Tillman.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the bill passes, and congratulations. Fantastic. Let's have Representative Buckley carry this, don't you think?
Representative Buckley suggested, and Representative Maurer agreed to carry this.
Oh, terrific.
Bill.
Representative Maurer, will you carry this bill?
Madam Chair, I will.
That's terrific. Thank you so much. I close the work session on House Bill 2506. This has been an incredible amount of work. I'm very proud of the people who worked on this. That's great. Okay, now we will open up what people have been waiting for, House Bill 2391. Representative Cowan, do you want to read this, or shall I have Keeley? Keeley, why don't we have Keeley start?
This bill directs the Department of Human Services to establish an education and assistance program aimed at seniors, people with disabilities, volunteer caregivers, and those approaching retirement that may be at risk of becoming impoverished or relying on public assistance. It establishes program guidelines for providing information, counseling, and services related to health care, long-term care, benefit and financial assistance programs, financial planning, and emergency and volunteer service. Directs DHS to report their progress, appropriates $30 million, and declares an emergency.
Representative Cowan, speaking of bills that have taken a long time to write and work with and working with many, many stakeholders.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Could I bring up Nicole Armstrong and Scott Bond as part of this panel?
Absolutely.
Please? Thank you very much. Madam Chair and members of this committee, thank you for getting this back here today. I think just briefly, what I would like to say is this may appear that there's a new program proposed, but this in reality is the logical and necessary next step in quite an extensive process. Briefly, I would mention that in 2007 we talked about funding for CNA, Certified Nursing Assistant Training, and we just recently celebrated the hiring of those 300, the final hiring of those 300 new providers, always with some attention on workforce issues in the whole arena of care for seniors and people with physical disabilities. In 2008, we came back and we talked and were successful budgetarily in increasing some Medicaid rates for mid-level providers, assisted livings, adult foster care, that we're now beginning to see a leveling out and a decrease in new nursing home admissions, where we had been concerned that that was beginning to creep upward in difference from what it had been doing. And we agreed to a comprehensive plan from the Department of Human Services and a review of what the necessary next steps might be in stabilizing Oregon's community-based long-term care system of services for seniors and people with physical disabilities. We do have that plan in place, and we know what some of the next steps are that we need to accomplish, hence House Bill 2930 or 2391 or whatever this one is. I can't remember the name, apparently. Primarily, it does two things. One is that it encourages cost avoidance, thoughtful, good decision-making at a point in one's life when they are needing to seek additional levels of care. It's aimed at what we like to call the pre-Medicaid population, individuals who, if their funds don't last long enough, may very well become Medicaid eligible and then be the responsibility of the state. But we have a variety of community-based care options as appropriate that are available to folks, be that in-home care or assisted living facilities or adult foster care. And sometimes folks just don't know where to turn. So the aging and disability resource centers that are part of this are sort of that first level assistance, information, referral, an opportunity to explore some of those options and to extend one's nest egg, if you will. And it also provides additional support for Oregon Project Independence, which is an in-home care program. I will mention the amendment that's before you. It's very simple. The dash one simply changes some verbiage on page one, line 18. As written, this says individuals approaching retirement. We're really talking about individuals who are approaching the need for late life care. Many of us retire before we're quite ready for some of this level of care. So that is the simple reasoning behind, I think, just an error in thought process when it was drafted. So I do recognize that
wait,
is
somebody,
not me.
I'm sorry, Representative. Somebody has their cell phone on. For those of you who didn't hear my speech at the beginning, your cell phones and blackberries and blueberries and raspberries need to be turned completely off, not just on mute, because it affects the sound system. Thank you. Sorry, Representative,
no
but
problem.
I could hear that. We
I
want
made
to
certain it
everything
is not
you
in
say.
My pocket. I do recognize that there is a significant cost associated with this. It has a $30 million price tag, and apparently we're not going to be able to move it on today because we don't have that official little fiscal impact document, but it is my hope that as soon as we get that this committee, on a policy basis, this being a logical next step in what we need to do, we'll move this committee forward, or this bill forward, so that we can have that conversation in the Ways and Means discussion around its cost and the fact that we are working hard on developing a revenue source to cover this. I've been working very closely with the Chair of Revenue Committee for some time now. So that's sort of a brief overview. I have a few folks here today who would like to speak briefly to the value of some of these programs and an individual who can explain a current pilot project for one of the ADRC kinds of concepts that might be able to answer a few questions about what those are envisioned to do.
Thank you, Representative.
You bet.
And we'll take questions after the panel speaks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Armstrong. I'm here on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. We would just like to start, start by thanking Representative Cowan and her many colleagues who've worked very hard to promote the needs of seniors and people with disabilities. And as she noted in the ongoing discussion this session about what we have, what we don't have, there's also the discussion about what we need as we go forward to make sure that we have the tools in our toolbox to go in the policy direction that Oregon is so noted for, which is the opportunity for seniors and people with disabilities to be able to stay as independent for as long as possible, to stay in their home and community for as long as they can, and to have excellent places to go at such time as they have to leave that home or community. And I think that House Bill 2391 is a step in that direction. I'll just briefly talk about what this bill could buy under the Aging Disability Resource Center type model. We have done some work on that, having looked at data from across the country of 43 states that currently use this type of model in their program. And based on the bill, we would estimate a total of 127,000 to 178,000 contacts per year made through the Aging and Disability Resource Center model. We would break that down at approximately 40,000 contacts through the Central Information Center and approximately 87 to 137,000 contacts made at the local or the regional level. And that's a significant amount of information about opportunities, about how to avoid the spend down, how to work with healthy aging, chronic disease management, all those different kinds of things that help people have the information they need to be able to make very sound decisions. It is a very difficult process to go through. It's a very emotional process when you're looking at how to retain the independence of yourself or somebody that you care about very much. And information, while it seems simple, can be very, very important to that. We looked at some of the information from evaluations that have been done on other aging disability resource centers, and an interesting note is that in states that use a single entry point under this model, they've seen very significant declines in Medicaid nursing facility users, and we think that in Oregon we can also adopt this model to continue the success we've seen and hopefully expand that. There certainly is the discussion right now, what can we afford to do and what can't we afford to do, and we're looking at a lot of very serious gaps in human services, and certainly my time is spent on the serious gaps in seniors and people with disabilities budgets and what we're going to do about that. But in order to manage those gaps in the future, we need some sort of methodology and way to help people make the decisions to focus on person-centered information and personal responsibility in order to be able to take advantage of Oregon's system of home and community-based care. I appreciated what the co-chairs of Human Services pointed out, that while we're looking at some very serious issues, we also need to look at the opportunities for innovation this session, because there can be, in light of the very dire situations that we are in, the opportunity to still head ourselves in the right policy direction that continues to set us up for hopefully not having to maybe face quite as serious of an issue as we are going to face in the rest of this biennium and the next. So with that, I will conclude my remarks, and I appreciate your consideration of this, and we encourage your support to move this conversation on to Ways and Means. Thank you.
Thank you, Nicole.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Scott Bonds. I'm the Director of Senior and Disability Services with Cascades West Council of Governments. We serve Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln counties. I'm also serving as the Chair of O4AD, and I sit on the board of the National Association of Area Agencies on Aging, representing Region 10. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you about House Bill 2391 this morning. And as you know, this bill proposes to invest in vital and essential services for seniors and people with disabilities in Oregon. This bill proposes to address the growing issues of an aging population here in Oregon through engaging in building strong community-based services that will promote person-centered planning, access to information on long-term care, evidence-based approaches to healthy aging, and disease prevention strategies. In 2008, we've seen the number of Americans over the age of 60 grow to more than 52 million, and by the year 2020, the number of Americans age 65 or older will be 70 million, or almost one in six. We know that the fastest growing group will be the population aged 85 or older, and that this group will have doubled by the age of 2020. And that research shows that, whether we like it or not, this 85-plus population will become a significant driver in the long-term care costs for our future. At the heart of HB 2391 is the belief that we, that as we give older adults and people with disabilities the opportunity to be involved in making their own health decisions, that they will make choices to manage their health and limit their risks of developing chronic health conditions. There's also a belief that when care options are available, people will choose to remain in their own homes or in home-like settings for as long as possible. This bill offers the opportunity to invest in the services and supports that encourage personal responsibility, family involvement, and the delay of unwanted institutionalization. All across the country, states have embraced these approaches to long-term care. And as Nicole said, there are 43 states, including Oregon, that have developed pilot projects, which mirror much of what you see in the bill. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, the Federal Administration on Aging, the National Association of State Units on Aging, and the National Association of Area Agencies on Aging have all endorsed the well-tested approaches of person-centered access to information and planning. This is the ADRC concept. The ADRC is a single point of entry, provides high-quality information and guidance in areas such as benefits planning and benefits coordination, helping consumers make informed choices, maximizing their choice as well as maximizing the efficient use of their personal funds and their family supports. The bill also begins to help Oregon embrace a broader and more uniform strategy of implementing evidence-based programs and healthy aging strategies that are based on scientific evidence, tested and researched, as well as replicated across the country. The recent report published by DHS and OHSU titled Healthy Aging in Oregon Counties 2009 details challenges as well as the successful implementation of several of these programs as pilots across the state. This is the time to follow the leadership of those who have implemented evidence-based programs and embrace the scientific method demonstrated and proven to reduce health costs in older adults and people with disabilities. This bill is, this bill is an opportunity to address a part of our issues in the long-term care system and prove that we can do cost-effective services and provide our citizens with the tools that they need to engage in planning for their own healthy future. Thank you very much.
Any question of anyone on this panel?
How many of the local assistance centers would there be?
How many
of the local assistance centers?
The concept is to have a central call center so that people can call in and talk to a human being, and then the local assistance centers will be in coordination with your local area on agencies. These are not new functions or new entities. This is a additional function of those that are in existence already, and for many of us, those are regional kinds of things, but in an area in each of our counties. These folks can tell you whether there are precisely one per county or not. I don't know the numbers, but it's in conjunction with them.
Chair Tomei, Representative Boone, under the planning that was taken on by O4AD as well as the Department of Human Services, it would be, as Representative Cowan noted, within the 17 area agencies and through those 17 cover all counties within the state of Oregon.
Thanks. Any other questions? Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. What's the impact on RSVP, Retired Senior Volunteer Program?
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, as a part of the overall model of ADRC's, volunteerism is a significant part of that, and what we would be able to do through this would be to look at the local partners that we have. RSVP is one of those programs in some of the areas that we are working in with the area agencies, and would be a part of the planning process to integrate and hopefully strengthen that. But that would be, we would have to look at that as we are going through the process. But volunteerism and those community-based volunteer programs are a part of the model.
That particular entity isn't specifically named, and part of the concept there is in the thinking as we've talked about all of this is that volunteerism is critical as we move forward, but maybe we need to begin to think outside of the boxes of certain programs right now, because we have a population like myself who are aging into that retired arena, but may have a variety of skills and mindsets that we'd like to bring to the age of volunteerism, if you will, and might not fit quite with some of the existing boxes. So we'd like to be broader thinking in what we might encourage people to participate, ways that we might encourage people to participate.
Any further questions? See none. Thank you all so much. We have quite a few people who have signed up to testify. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. So I'm going to ask people to hold their testimony to 2 or 3 minutes. Kay Metzger, Tim McQuarrie, and Bob Lawrence. And if you have written testimony, please give it to us and just summarize what you're saying in your written testimony. That would be great.
Chair Tolmay, members of the committee, my name is Kay Metzger. I'm the director with Senior and Disabled Services, Lane Council of Governments. We're the area agency on aging for Lane County. And I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2391, giving you thoughts from a local perspective. We actually are the agency that the Department of Human Services is partnering with on a grant, part of which will establish a local aging and disability resource center. So I wanted to give you some thoughts on our local experience so far. First of all, what we're seeing in Lane County, obviously as across the state, is a growing need for information and assistance to people that are aging and those with disabilities. We actually, in our role as the Medicaid and food stamp agency, we serve over 13,000 people in Lane County. And we answer a lot of calls, handle a lot of information related to that role. However, in addition to that role and questions about Medicaid and food stamps, last year we had over 36,000 contacts, interactions with people that had questions apart from Medicaid and food stamps. And these folks couldn't find information elsewhere, so they came to us. We were able to begin to meet that need using a small amount of revenue from the Older Americans Act that we receive, specifically to serve people over the age of 60. And what we've been able to do is fund a program called the Senior Connections Program that has staff stationed in different parts of the county, rural areas, from Oak Ridge over to Florence, Veneta, Junction City, other locations in between, to really work with the people in their communities and answer those questions. And these folks, as they have been interacting with members of their community, we really found three main areas that we're seeing a need. And the first is that folks, while they find the web-based tools helpful and informational, they're not sufficient when you get to a situation where you need some consultation regarding long-term care issues. And sometimes home visits even are necessary. You can't really get a full picture of what the situation of the person is until you see them face-to-face. So our staff are able to make home visits. In fact, I was speaking yesterday with our staff person that's based in Eugene. Last month, she made 67 home visits. So she's very, very busy interacting with folks and helping people out. The second thing we found is that information and assistance that's provided in the early stages really serves to help prevent deterioration. And when you can intervene with less expensive care, even using volunteers, it really helps to deter the need for Medicaid and more expensive care.
I ask you to wrap up pretty quickly.
Okay. And then the third thing is helping people connect with other programs that link to the Oregon Telephone Assistance Program or to the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. That's key, too. So I just wanted to give you a little picture on what we're finding and that we look forward to further funding and work in the grant towards implementation. Thank
Great.
You.
Thank you. And we're going to hear you in just a second. I think Bob Lawrence, wherever you are, didn't hear me.
Madam Chair, Tim McQuarrie is going to testify for the commission.
Great. Got it.
Okay.
Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tim McQuarrie. I reside in Sweet Home, and I am presently a member of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, and I also serve as the chair of the Senior Services Advisory Council for the Cascade West in Albany, Oregon. I'm here today to speak about House Bill 2391. It is truly the next step coming after what was asked for in Senate Bill 1061. And even in these difficult economic times, we are going to have to come out of the other side of this with our long-term care system still intact. So I believe this is the start. It doesn't answer everything that we need, but we need some foundation here as we come out of this. And I think we also really need to take into consideration that many of the people that are served by this type of legislation are not the ones that by choice have abused drugs or the ones that have broken the laws of our land or our prison systems, but these are folks who have worked 40-plus years of their life, they paid their taxes, and they've contributed to society. And they are not there looking for a handout. They just want to finish their life out with as much dignity in place as they possibly can. And this is going to be the short version, but we need to make sure that OPI is stable coming out of this. We're on the edge of the cliff right now, and we need to continue that successful program. The Governor's Commission fully supports the passage of this legislation as we did with Senate Bill 1061, and we know that you will do the best you can under the circumstances that you face, and I want to thank you all for your time today and for everything you do for the citizens of Oregon. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Any quick questions of this panel? Thank you so much for all that you do for the citizens of Oregon, too. Thank you. So we have Rick Bennett, Amber Kern Johnson, and Ruth McEwen.
Can we open up a passageway over here?
What do we need, Jean?
They're getting through. Ruth is trying to get through.
Oh,
traffic control.
Traffic control, okay. Thank you, Zach. We're going to let you just start ahead while Ruth is getting situated. Go ahead.
Go first. Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amber Kern Johnson, and I'm the Executive Director of the Hollywood Senior Center, a multi-purpose senior center in Multnomah County. We're also a contractor for the provision of Oregon Project Independence Services. I thank you for the opportunity to offer testimony regarding Oregon Project Independence, or OPI, and the importance of House Bill 2391 in preserving Oregon's very effective and long-standing community-based long-term care system. We have currently 105 senior clients, and 55 of those receive OPI case management services and case management. Direct services include foot care, dusting, vacuuming, laundry, bathing, and chronic disease management, as well as many other essential services. We currently have 13 individuals on a waiting list who need OPI services. Our OPI case management clients receive on typical 2 to 10 hours a week of services. The majority of our clients are women who have worked low-paying jobs their entire life and who exist on under $1,000 a month. Some rent subsidized apartments, but others take great pride in owning their modest homes, homes they have lived in for much of their life, and they cherish these homes, and the ability to live independently is a symbol of their dignity. Shirley is one of our clients. She's 74 years old and disabled and in a power chair. She has received OPI services since 2007, and she writes, "I live in a senior building in a one-bedroom apartment. I have a caregiver, and a housekeeper provided by the Hollywood Senior Center and Oregon Project Independence. I get utility and phone help. I get help with transportation to and from the store weekly, and et cetera. These services cost me little or nothing on my limited income. The most important to me can be summed up in two words: independent living. These services make this a reality for me, and in doing so, they had given me my freedom and my life back. Freedom means that I can eat what I want, go to bed when I want, do my own shopping. You get the idea, I'm sure. This freedom is so important to me. It gives me back my humanity. Can there be anything more important? Cuts to OPI means loss of independence and dignity for many Oregonians. Without these services, their ability to live independently is severely compromised. It will only be a matter of time before our clients receiving OPI services will have no other option but to go into nursing homes. In addition, the elimination of OPI means the elimination or reduction of work for case management staff and for home care workers throughout Oregon. OPI keeps seniors from premature assisted living. It keeps people safe in their homes without reducing their autonomy and freedom of choice. These are very difficult and unusual times, and there are no easy choices, but I feel strongly that in these times, it's our most vulnerable population which must be a priority, and cuts we make today will be very difficult to restore in the future. House Bill 2391 is critical in establishing and directing funding to OPI. On behalf of the Hollywood Senior Center, Shirley, and seniors all over Oregon, I want to thank Chair Tomei and members of the committee for the opportunity to speak today, and for Representative Cohen, who has done a tremendous job in working on this bill and getting it to this point. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Amber.
Okay.
Ruth, can you move the microphone over to her? Thank you. Thank you for coming today.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Ruth McEwen. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Disabilities Commission, and we are in support of House Bill 2391, and we want to express our concern that this is something that will help keep people out of the Medicaid system longer, and that it is, you know, our Medicaid services are limited only to people with Medicaid now. Therefore, we think that this would be a great way of helping people and individuals stay independent, healthy, and safe while either avoiding or minimizing their needs for Medicaid funding long-term care services. The program is also very vital for people with disabilities. In the written report, there are three main issues that we are concerned with: the Central Information Center to provide information and referral for prevention and intervention activities, benefits, counseling, and education for healthy living; local assistance centers in Oregon communities that provide counseling, access to services, short-term case management, and access to emergency and adult protective services; and to direct services such as in-home services, caregiver supports, volunteer services, and financial planning and healthy living. We are also concerned with the Oregon Project Independence and the funding for that, and have hopes that someday there will be sufficient funding so that it can be expanded to people with people with disabilities. And since the ADRCs are already established in 43 other states, we are trying to figure out why Oregon has been behind in this one, since Oregon's always been ahead in all the long-term care system. And so we are asking that you support this bill and to have it moved on.
Thank
and for
so
a
much.
Personal caveat, I'd like to say I wish there had been an ADRC facilities for when I needed to find resources and information, instead of having to just try to scramble to see what's there, because I think this could be very valuable and very meaningful to people.
Great. Thank you for coming to testify.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP. also speaking on behalf of the Campaign for Seniors and People with Disabilities as well. I'll be brief. You have a prepared statement from the campaign. Let me just hit a couple of key bullets. The campaign supports the core concepts embodied in House Bill 2391, as its provisions are among our legislative priorities as well. Essential funding for programs like Oregon Project Independence is essential. Information and referral resources like the ones included in the Aging and Disability Resource Center concept are considered a best practice in helping individuals and families navigate the long-term care system, and appropriate family caregiving support will bolster a vital component and backbone of the long-term care in Oregon. Again, the campaign supports this bill. We want to thank Representative Cowan for bringing it forward, and also AARP Oregon. We've had a long history of our support for home and community-based services and programs, and we also support the public policy that's indicated in this bill as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thanks for all the work you've done, all of you, on this bill and helping people who need help in Oregon. Thank you so much. Okay, next we have Megan Moyer, Phyllis Rand, and Ozzie Rose.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee. I'm Phyllis Rand, and I'm chair of Northwest Senior and Disability Services Advisory Council. And so I'm here today in support of House Bill 2391. And one, you know, we've been talking a lot about what this bill does, but I've listened carefully, and there's one thing that I haven't heard, and that is it brings quality to seniors and people with disabilities in their lives. And I just think that's a very important issue. And so with that, I'm going to let the other people testify.
Thank you, Phyllis. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I represent the Service Employee International Union, Local 503, where we have nearly 15,000 frontline workers working in long-term care. I'm also testifying on behalf of the Campaign for Seniors and People with Disabilities, of which we are an active participant in support of this bill. Many of the concepts of this bill are fundamental in the long-range plan that we were stakeholders in, with the department, as well as core principles in reinvestment in long-term care for the campaign. It is important to look to our future, and as many people have testified before me, that we are going to have increased demand for services for seniors and people with disabilities. And the ADRC, as well as Oregon Project Independent and other resources for people who are not in the Medicaid population, is essential for sustaining these programs into the next couple decades. I don't want to repeat what everyone else has said, but I would definitely wish to echo its importance as we look toward not only sustaining what we have, but improving quality and meeting the needs of growing populations. The components of this bill, I really think, will be essential for Oregon's future.
Great. Thank you, Megan.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Ozzie Rhodes. I represent the Oregon Alliance for Seniors and Health Services, a nonprofit long-term care facilities organization. Very briefly, I'm here to add my voice to especially the first portion of this bill, the ADRCs. We need to do more and more with planning and helping. You've heard the numbers, but we're going to be inundated with a population that needs services. And the better the job we do at helping them make good decisions and be prepared, that the better off we'll be financially in terms of dealing with problems of state dollars. State dollars right now are a significant issue. Everybody knows that. But we can't not think ahead just because we're short of money right now. Whether this gets funded, to what degree it gets funded, that's an issue that will be dealt with in the Ways and Means process as we set priorities, as it should be. But it's not the first time that we've had things before us that require priorities in terms of the final budget. and I encourage you to move this down to the Ways and Means and get this process underway.
Thank you. Any questions of this panel? Thank you for coming today, and thanks for all the work that you do for seniors and folks with disabilities. We'll move on to Jim Davis and Ali Zamani. That's all I have signed up to speak. Is there anyone else? We do have time now, since I've hurried people up. So come on up. Come on, Ali. John will put you on the next panel. Anyone else who would like to speak? And then what I'm going to do is ask people who haven't had a chance to speak, I'm going to ask you to stand up and tell us who you are and if you're in favor of this bill and where you're from. So if you don't want to be on camera, you'd better leave pretty soon.
Can we leave?
Jim, good to see you.
Good to see you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, a gerontologist, psychologist, and professor from Portland, Oregon, here today representing the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, United Seniors of Oregon, Save Oregon Seniors, and the Oregon Alliance for Retired Americans. And we, too, are part of the Senior and Disability Campaign, our united effort to save senior and disability services. We strongly support 2391, and before I make a few brief remarks about that, we wanted to thank Representative Cowan, who has done a wonderful, wonderful job and really has become the senior and disability champion of the House, and that is something when you look at all the fine people sitting around on this panel and all the amazing work that is done by some of you wonderful people up there, but Representative Cowan has gone above and beyond, and we appreciate it very, very much. House Bill 2391 represents an excellent vision for a preventative approach to our senior and disability service system. And prevention is often undervalued and underappreciated and not usually funded at the levels that it should be. But I think the recommendations being made in this bill will make a much more effective use of our senior and disability service network. And I think the aging and disability resource centers are a very good model, and I hope they have the opportunity to be developed. Our greatest interest here is in Oregon Project Independence, which is now bankrupt. I have been working with OPI since the very beginning, when I interned on the Special Committee on Aging in the House in 1975 with Ralph Croner as the co-chair. So I love this program very, very much, and I've seen it grow into a marvelous national model, a critical safety net for the near poor who do not qualify for Medicaid. But we've seen a very, very sad situation over the last few years, and I want to address this. In 2005, many of us worked very hard to pass the OPI Modernization Act. And that, through that act, we were able to expand OPI, as we had hoped, to reach people with disabilities. And to be able to do this, we looked at a strong general fund base with a reserve fund. The reserve fund coming from the tax deferral program that would then feed into Oregon Project Independence and allow enough money to reach out to people with disabilities. That really was the vision. And it was a strong vision, and that's how we wanted to expand OPI. But in 2007, I get totally against what any of us would feel the legislative intent was. OPI was taken out of the general fund. The reserve fund was gutted. And now OPI stands bankrupt. And we truly feel that the Oregon legislature and many of our friends who are sitting in front of us now need to make this right and need to restore OPI at its fullest levels. And we feel that very, very strongly because I've been involved with this for 35 years, and I've never seen a decision that had such negative impact on such a critical program. And so we just really need to make this right. I wanted to add that We agree with the cap on Oregon's medical deduction expense. We have been eyeing that for some time now. And we feel very, very strongly that any savings that comes from that should be geared to seniors and people with disabilities. We love Representative Cowan's approach to this, but no matter what happens, that money should be used for our populations. And that's something we feel very strongly about. So anyway, we're great support of this effort, and thank you very much for letting me speak.
Thank you, Tom.
Madam Chair, Tomei, respected members of the committee, as you know, I represent adultcare.org, a private sector that provides and has been an advocate for elders and seniors with people and people with disabilities in the state of Oregon. Initially, when in October 2007, when I introduced the adultcare.org to this committee and the interim committee, we brought a program that brought the informational resource center and created through a technology and adopted transparency and accountability and brought accountability to the whole industry. This program serves the seniors and the consumers of this state. Has been in operation for past 2 years. We are in support of the House Bill 2391 and as well as 2442, and we hope to also assist by means of providing our services and our system and our program, reducing the fiscal budget impact and helping this two bill pass through the committee and become actually act. Our program not only provides the information system services, but also we bring consumer interaction that helps the quality of elders and seniors in a long-term care to be risen to the level that it should be. We all hear throughout the news and the media that the event that takes place either through the caregivers' lack of services or adequate services or damages or injuries to the elders throughout these facilities, and rather than becoming adverse and creating an issue, we would like to basically bring technology and education to this organization and help them to make the event much better. That's pretty much
it. Thank you so much for your testimony.
Madam Chair,
thank you for coming. Yes, Representative.
Hopefully, a quick question.
Sure.
Thank you. Ali, how do you see your system fitting in, and where do you get the information?
Well, we have worked closely in with the Department of Human Services. We get all of our system and information through the Department of Human Services. All of licensed care providers that there are, or people that are basically licensed in not only in the state of Oregon but in all 50 states, are provided by the departments, and we also. Communicate directly with the caregivers and the providers to make sure that the information are adequate and are up to date, and we also pass that information to the agencies as they require. And we basically, how do we participate in this? We are the source. We are the information source that has been in place for past 2 years, and doing the same services that the House Bill 2391 is asking for.
Representative Friedman?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and hopefully this is a quick question also. I'm kind of intrigued that somebody's kind of doing this maybe a little bit in partnership with government and not exclusively government. How many customers or people are in your program? How big of a, you know, of an endeavor is this that you're involved in?
Well, Madam Chair Tomei and Representative Friedman, we have... past 2 years, we have had over 300,000 consumers utilizing our program, getting information, and utilizing our resources. We are currently in 31 states. We are moving to all 50 states, looking to include over 250,000 licensed care providers that particularly provide services to the long-term care and seniors with people with disabilities.
Just a quick follow-up.
Really quick.
Okay. I'm assuming you work with DHS and are kind of a partner with them. Am I understanding that right?
We don't want to misrepresent. We are a private sector, and we do get, however, our data from the Department of Human Services, and we post those information up.
Okay.
Short one. Sure. Thank you, Chair Tomei. Are you primarily an internet service?
We are, Madam Chair Tomei and Representative Van Orman. Not only we are the internet service, but we also have live representative that people, when they need information, that they don't have access to the computers or they don't know how to operate those the technology, they can call to our office and get the information that we can provide for them, or they ask.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead and tell us your name, please.
For the record, my name is Gretchen Muckin. I'm a case manager for Neighborhood House in downtown Portland. I apologize. I hadn't prepared anything formal because I had not intended to speak. This scares me to death. So, but I wanted to just express kind of a snapshot of what OPI looks like for our clients. On the ground every day, logistically. We have kind of a unique situation in downtown Portland because we serve mostly males. We have a lot of mental health and substance abuse issues. So that kind of plays into the difficulty, and a lot of times the OPI services are preventing evictions. We get that a lot where we're called by a building manager or a service provider because they're going to be evicted and they need some help. Our typical client receives less than 10 hours a month, which when you look at what that actually costs the state, I'm pulling these numbers from the O4AD information, but a typical OPI client, it costs $250 per month, whereas Medicaid would be $600 a month for in-home services. I guess what I'm trying to say is that the typical need that we see is a very, very small need. When you talk about the logistics, just a couple of hours a month to have someone come and vacuum for you so that you don't fall and injure yourself greatly and need nursing home care, to remove the possibility of having that as an option to where there's this huge gap. I mean, we are the safety net. We are the safety net for people that don't qualify for Medicaid but do have legitimate needs and are needing those to remain independent, that to remove that would be devastating, quite frankly, because these are needs that are not going to go away. They're problems that only get amplified with a lack of services. So I urge you to support this bill. We really need it. We have a wait list currently of, I think, about 13 people. And so we go out and we do the assessments just like we would anybody else, but we don't have any resources to offer. And so I think for us that has become really clear why this funding is so crucial, because we're getting an idea of what is this going to look like if OPI is gone, and it's going to be devastating. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for coming to testify. Could you give us your name again, please?
Yes, Gretchen Muckin.
Thank you. How do you spell that last name?
Muckin.
Thanks so much, Gretchen. Thanks for the work you do, and thanks for bringing this message to us. Representative Mood. Oh,
thank you, Madam Chair. This question for Jim. So, if someone calls to get OPI at this point, there are waiting lists. There's no services available.
Wait, Madam Chair, Representative Boone, I think that's a question you need to ask the area agencies on aging. I think it's different in each area, and I think in terms of when the money's going to run out. So, I guess the term is the bankrupt is used more broadly in that services are still being provided, but it all of a sudden it's going to stop. It's just there's nothing else there. There's no general fund base. There's nothing left in the reserve. So it's like there's nothing left. Yeah.
Follow up. I just wanted to say I've been making these referrals all session so far, and I hope they're not meeting a dead end.
I don't know if Nicole is still here. If she is, maybe
she is.
Nicole, if you could, you don't need to give us that information now. If you could email us with an answer to that would be terrific. Thank you. Thank you all
Madam
so much
Chair,
for coming.
Can I have one?
Sure.
Thank you. I guess I understand OPI is overwhelmingly supported, but yet when we had huge increases in revenue, the program was cut, and now that when we have declining revenue base, the program's cut now to nothing, but yet the state's going to have to pay for these people when they move into nursing homes. So I guess I don't understand why are we attacking a program that's going to save the state money? I mean, I guess I don't understand the rationale for why that even makes policy sense as to why we would do that. Can you answer that?
That's an interesting question. I think we all wonder whether or not it makes any sense. We've been fighting hard for OPI, even in the good times, and have never truly understood why we can't get greater support for this effort. It is a national model, and what it is essentially, it's a very, very small part of a budget of billions of dollars. It's this very small aspect of it that helps take care of people who fall through the cracks. And I think there's been a lot of interesting rumors that have flown around that, you know, people of better means have been able to access OPI and that it's really not, you know, reaching those that are in the greatest need. And it couldn't be further from the truth. The OPI, those people who are falling through the cracks, are usually near poor individuals with great needs who with OPI are able to stay in their own communities. And it's such a cost-effective program. And of course, our vision has always been that we wanted to expand OPI so that it reached all our populations, including people with disabilities. And that was the whole effort of the 05 legislation. And I think it's gone totally against the intent of that modernization legislation passed in 2005.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could just add a little bit for the committee as well. First of all, I want to make it clear that when this bill was written was like last November, when we were not at the situation that we're in right now. And the intention of the piece that's in the bill for Oregon Project Independence was intended to be supplemental, an additional piece of the existing program. As we all know, things have changed rather dramatically since that thinking in November, and there is a great deal of work being done right now on maintaining the current OPI program. We do know that the revenue picture in the property tax deferral fund that currently is the source of income for that program is projected to disintegrate, and there are conversations going on right now about the program, and it isn't gone yet, Representative Boone. Those referrals are not going anywhere. We know that there are some grave concerns before that we need to take action before the end of this session, and the conversations that I've been having with revenue are kind of multifaceted and involve some stabilization of that primary funding source in the property tax deferral fund, and then looking at some supplemental funding in this bill as well. But there's flexibility in here that we can work with numbers if we need to. So I would like to take the anxiety away from the comments that I've heard around the program is gone. That is not the situation right now, but there is a grave need to address the challenges that it's facing. And I think there is recognition for the fact that it's an extremely valuable program. But please understand that what's in this specific bill was intended initially to be supplemental at a time when things were a little bit different. So we will be flexible as we move forward.
Thank you. Quick, is this a question? Or
yes, it is a question.
Great.
It's thank you, Madam Chair. It's a question about if push came to shove. I think what I hear is real support for OPI as opposed to a resource center. If you had to choose between the two, I think OPI comes to the top. Is that a fair assessment?
To whom are you sending that first?
Madam Chair and Representative. Yes, if push came to shove, we would strongly support money going back into Oregon Project Independence because our advocates have made a pretty strong statement that we want first and foremost to save those programs that are being cut, and OPI is near the top of the list to get that back to normal funding levels. But we very much support the preventative approach that's being called for in this bill, and I think you could use a lot of current resources to develop this concept. So it's a great concept, but most certainly we need to save OPI.
Okay, thank you.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
This was not planned.
Well, I feel it necessary to make it clear that at this point in time, the conversation is about the concepts that are in this bill in terms of carrying forward a continuing conversation that started at the end of 2007 session when many of us felt that we needed to take a different approach, and we brought all of the interested parties together, as many as we could get in a room at any one time, and we began to plan progressively over a number of bienniums about what we could do. And this is a step in that process, and I'm pretty passionate about keeping some focus on continued planning for the long term. I would really urge this committee to not set this up as a, if you can only have one, which one of these two do you want, because there are other conversations going on in revenue about ways to coordinate all of this and also to stabilize the Oregon Project Independence Program. So this bill is not intended to get set up as a one or the other. Please.
I'm sorry.
Representative Cowan, about how many meetings do you think you've had with stakeholders over these several years?
Well, I can pretty much tell you, there's a lot of familiar faces in this room. We have been meeting pretty continuously since the end of the 2000 session as this whole comprehensive plan developed. It was rewritten about, I don't know, a gazillion times to try to make sure that we address things as much as possible. There's been a great deal of effort that's gone into it, and I really appreciate all the folks that have come here today to voice their support, because everyone comes at it from the whole question from a number of different directions. And in all fairness, everyone in this room represents in some way their kind of key program or their primary focus, and to bring all of those, which could be competing programs when you've got a limited source of funds, together and try to work things out that balance and try to prioritize what's the highest need at this given moment is a challenge, but people are extremely committed to this effort. And I'm very appreciative of everyone who came today. So thank you for your time and the attention this committee has given this issue.
And certainly thank you, Representative, for all the time and attention you have given it.
Well, that's getting a little embarrassing.
Well, it's been incredible. Thank you all so much.
Thank you so much.
And John, and I've asked for other people, only we don't have time. So, John, if you will quickly give us your message.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I'll be very brief, but I'm happy to be here with my colleagues and friends to talk about these programs. I think they're very, very important. Just a very quick perspective, I first came to Oregon in 1975, became involved in Older American Act programs, could see what was needed and what the issues were with elderly people nationally. And Oregon took the amazing step in 1975 of creating Oregon Project Independence. 2 years later, I was running the program. At its height in Clackamas County, when I was running the program, we were serving about 150 households, and that it hasn't grown over that period of time, even though the population has grown and the needs and challenges have grown. As I think back on those days, the issues that were most needed for older Americans at that time were access to services and having information and then having the services themselves. And I would just submit that after 30 years or more, those conditions are still the same. And I think that the reason that I wanted to just put an exclamation point on the discussion that Representative Cowan has just led is that OPI is at a critical juncture because the funding is uncertain, even though Representative Cowan is diligently working on a solution for all that. I just think that there are thousands of people around the state that would be affected if OPI just all of a sudden went off the cliff. And the last thing that I would mention as far as the Oregon Law Center is concerned, the reason that we support Oregon Project Independence is because we know from taking a look at the information that the vast number of people on Oregon Project Independence are in fact not only impaired as far as their disabilities are concerned, but they're also low income, which is something that there have been some misconceptions at times about OPI that need to be dispelled, but the information clearly shows that this is a very vulnerable population in need of service.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
And again, I just want to point out, too, that I don't know all the hours. I know Representative Cowan has put in multiple hours and days and weeks and months and years on this issue. She's gotten all of the stakeholders involved and have gotten them focused on this bill. And I feel very protective of this bill and want to make sure that we send it forward intact with our support. So I appreciate all the work you've put in on this. So what I'm going to do now is ask people who have not had a chance to testify, who are in favor of this bill, to stand up and tell us your name and where you're from. And I know you're here. So, yes, sir.
Madam Chair and representatives of the committee, my name is Scott Werdebaugh, and I serve the stroke people. I hold the Stroke Survivors and Caregiver Support Group, and we have people coming there all the time asking for information. Where do I go? What do I do now? I just had a stroke. And
just tell us where you're from, if you will.
I'm from Independence, Oregon.
Great. Thank you so much for coming. Yes, anybody else? Stand up and tell us your... Yes.
I'm Charles Richards, and I basically am a volunteer junkie. I'm involved with so many organizations. I never know what hat to tell you I wear. I'm very proud of an organization nationally. I'm National Silver Hair Congress.
Great. And where are you from, sir?
I'm from here in Salem.
Great. Thank you so much for coming. Anyone else? Yes.
I'm Robert McDonald from Silverton. I'm a family physician with extra qualifications in geriatric medicine. Currently, I'm on the Advisory Council for Senior Disability Services.
Great. Thank you so much for coming today. Anyone else would like to stand and tell us where they're from? And all right. Well, thank you all for coming again. Thank you, committee. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Cowan. If we had more time, I would go into a work session for... Shall I do that for the...
For the dash ones?
Yeah. Great. Okay, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2391 and open up a work session on 2391. Representative Cowan?
Madam Chair, I move the approval of the dash one amendments to House Bill 2391.
Representative Cowan moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2391. Any discussion? Any objection? So moved. And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2391. And yes, what?
If you'd like to carry that over along with House Bill 2442 to Monday, I think we'll probably have all the fiscals back by then.
So done. We'll carry House Bill 2391 over to Monday, and we will also carry House Bill 2442 over to Monday. And before I end this meeting, I would like to encourage people to bring their bill files to the meeting. And would it be helpful if I were to ask Keely to email your staff to remind them to pull your bill files? Would that be helpful? No?
Hold it. I just left it on my desk.
Oh.
Do you want your bill back?
There's only so much staff can do, Representative.
Okay. All right. Okay. I close the House Committee.